Hey folks, it's Bill here. A couple things I wanted to cover. First, thank you very much for listening to the 200th episode of So Many Bits. I started doing this 4 years ago, and I can't really believe that I've gone this far with it. This was a thing I wanted to do in my free time where I talked about video games with my friends, and it's gone in directions I couldn't really imagine. And one of those is something that I am excited to talk about today for the first time. I'm launching a Patreon, patreon.com/somanybits, for giving a small pledge to the podcast. You're able to access some extra features. You can get notes that I take on the episodes prior to recording with the interview guests or on the screen watching segments. You can get early access to episodes starting next week, where they'll drop 1 week early through the Patreon feed, and a couple other benefits that I'll leave to you to check out. So I really hope you'll give that consideration. If not, you know, thank you very much anyway for listening. And now, on to the episode. Welcome to So Many Bits. I'm your host, Bill Nielsen, and joining me from this palatial VoIP line in the middle of the internet is Cliff Murphy. Cliff, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, Bill. Thanks for having me again.
It's been a couple weeks, I think, since we've had you last on, so I just, you know, good to get you back in the rotation. things haven't changed too much since you were last on.
Okay, cool. So we'll do more of the same?
Yeah, so we'll talk about one game really intensely, go deep into it for about 45 minutes. At a certain point, I'll admit that I only played like 3 or 4 hours of it, and like I just looked up the rest on YouTube.
Okay. All right. That works for me. Then I won't feel too bad knowing that I also did the exact same thing and played for a few minutes and then looked up everything on YouTube.
So for any new listeners, Cliff and I were the original two hosts. We had this format where we would take a look at one game or one game franchise and kind of like break it down comedically, talk about like the different plot elements, characters, stuff like that. And Cliff was kind enough to do that with me for about, I think, like 45 episodes.
Something like that. I don't remember the exact number.
And I think at that point, we just kind of ran out of games that we'd either already played or ran out of time to like play new games to invest more material. At that point, we shifted the podcast. I talked a bit more with people local to me here in Chicago. But Cliff, thank you so much for coming back on, because this is episode number 200 of the podcast.
Episode number 200. I applaud you. Congratulations, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you so much. As a Professor Farnsworth said on Futurama one time, I deserve this.
You absolutely do.
So Cliff, I think we talked a little bit beforehand, but later on in this episode, I'm going to be having an interview going on with Harris Foster over at Finji. Finji is the developer / publisher behind a few different titles, such as Cannibalt. They're working on Overland, and you may best know them for Night in the Woods.
Of the ones that you said, the one that I know them the best for is Cannibalt. I have that on my phone right now. That's amazing.
Yeah. That was, I think, the very first title they worked on, and it's kind of like a mobile classic, as much as there are any mobile games that have made it to classic status at this point.
Yeah, when you talk to him, do me a favor and ask him if it's possible to get past the first 10 seconds or so of that game, because I find it very challenging.
I'll bring that up for sure.
Yeah, see if they say it might be a bug. I don't know if they have checked that game, but something to fix.
That's maybe the secret, is there's only like 15 seconds of actual gameplay, and they had to make it really, really hard to make it last.
Yeah, they did the Nintendo thing, right?
So yeah, later on, Harris and I will be chatting. But first, Cliff, you and I have to do some screen watching.
I was outside watching some deer frolic. You don't even care about the outside, do you?
Ooh, yes, let's watch that screen.
And for this episode, we're going to be talking about, you know, I have to admit, I had never seen this series before watching as research. We're going to be talking about Black Mirror.
Oh, it is so thrilling. I'm so excited for you because hopefully you've enjoyed this episode and you want to watch the rest of the series because there's just so many great things throughout. When I say great, I largely mean horrifying, but it's a fantastic series. But yeah, Black Mirror, and we watched Playtest specifically, the second episode of the third season.
That's right, yes, Playtest, Season 3, Episode 2, original air date October 21st, 2016. And yeah, I don't know exactly what I was expecting coming into this, but this ruffled my jimmies.
Yeah, I was reading some of the Wikipedia pages, and Charlie Brooker normally has some message that he wants to include in the show. You know, something saying something about the dangers of technology and some reason or another. I don't know, whatever he wants to say. But for this episode in particular, he just wanted to make it super scary. And so he put in as many Jimmy Russell-ing moments as he possibly could.
I think relevant to the setup for this episode, Mr. Brooker and his co-staff on the show, they have a background in video games, right?
As far as I can tell, I think I only knew that it was him in some way. But if the staff also has a history in it, then I guess that would make sense given what happens in the episode.
Mr. Charlie Brooker, he was a game reviewer, right? Before he started working in the TV industry.
I do remember seeing in the episode, there's one shot of one of the characters, Sonya, her apartment, and she's got a whole bunch of games that are sitting on the shelf. And from what I gathered from the Wikipedia page on the episode, the games that are on there are all games that I guess he must have reviewed early on in his career, which is pretty neat. It is a bizarre collection of games outside of that, though, because there are a bunch of big hits on there, like Metal Gear Solid's in there, Heavy Rain, Dark Souls 2, like all of these big, huge games. And then there's also the Lego Movie video game in there. And I thought that was just a real strange game.
So maybe it's best if we kind of like go through the episode as the plot unravels, and then we can stop and talk about things that interested us along the way.
Okay, so at the beginning, it shows this young guy with blonde hair and a beard, and he leaves home and starts going on this worldwide trip, and it shows him going to a whole bunch of different places. I think he's shown in Egypt, he's shown in England. I think he finally ends up in England at the end there. He's looking around and kind of seeing what's going on. He notices there's another couple, and then he gets kind of lonely on the trip, and he starts using one of those swipe left, swipe right apps, the Tinder sort of clones, the non-specific Tinder-esque app that they've got in the Black Mirror universe. And he ends up...
Yeah, it resembles a dating app, but like it seems like very specifically they chose not to exactly parody one. Like he's swiping back and forth, but he's not like matching with anyone that way. He's like looking at, like kind of shopping through the different photos that way. It felt like that was a conscientious choice on their part.
Probably is. I don't know how much those... how much that technology of going to the right, going to the left, that's not really technology. What would you call that? Software, I guess? I don't know how much that's patented. Anyway, he ends up meeting up. This character's name is Cooper, by the way. Cooper ends up meeting up with a woman named Sonya at a bar, and they hit it off pretty well, and he's talking to her, and things go the way that you might expect they would in a television show. And the next day they're in her apartment, and he sort of makes some observations about how she's a gamer and she's got games around and these sorts of things. And then they separate. They go their separate ways. And I guess a little while later, Cooper tries to get some money out from an ATM and discovers that his card's been compromised, and he doesn't have any money. He doesn't know what to do. So instead of calling his mom for support or advice or whatever, which he briefly considers, he ends up calling Sonya again and meeting her back at her apartment. I should mention at this point, too, that it's an ongoing thing that Cooper seems to have some sort of issue with his mom. It's mentioned in the show that his father passed away from Alzheimer's, and he doesn't know how to talk to his mom or connect with his mom in some way or another. Long story short, he doesn't want to be around his mom or talk to his mom in one reason or another, so he avoids calling her throughout the show, which ends up being sort of a recurring theme of calling mom.
My first read on that was that Cooper was BSing, that he didn't, I didn't realize like that actually his father had passed. I thought he was making up a reason to give himself sympathy, because like Sonya at one point notices the call from his mom and she's like, "You're not going to answer that?" And he's like, at first he's just like, "Oh, my mom is like looking, she's alone, she's lonely, but also I'm feeling bad too." So I thought he was like trying to shield himself.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, he's just trying to get sympathy or something from just a random call from his mom. Yeah, I could have seen that.
But yeah, so maybe I'll pick up there. So like Cooper, he ends up having to crawl back to Sonya because he has no one else he knows in England, and he just needs a place to crash until he can get enough money together to get out of there. And that's where he's not, again, this is a thing where it's like they are avoiding naming the app, but it looked a lot like, or sounded a lot like Fiverr. Which is this odd job app.
Yeah, an app just to do random things around the city for different people.
Exactly, yeah. And Sonya calls out, they're like, "Oh, there's this ad here for the company Saitogemo, and they are looking for thrill seekers to come test their new software."
Here's an interesting thing about that, because the whole series Black Mirror has a whole bunch of little connections to it. If you haven't watched any of the other episodes, from what you told me earlier, you started watching the Bandersnatch one and then realized partway through that that was the wrong episode.
I just kind of checked out when I saw you're like, "Let's watch the Black Mirror." Cause like, just, so for people behind the scenes, I have a Google Doc of like TV shows that have like gaming episodes. And I forgot that there was Bandersnatch and a separate listing for Black Mirror, so I started watching Bandersnatch for like an hour, and then I looked back at our DMs and I was like, oh, I'm watching the wrong thing.
And that's of all the ones to pick too, because that's the one with all the like branching choices, and you can like go back and watch things in different ways. That's a big commitment to make accidentally.
Oh yeah, yeah. Good news, I'm ready for when another guest wants to talk about it.
But in Black Mirror, in all these different episodes, they all take place in completely separate worlds or time periods, whatever you want to say. Some of them are very close to modern day. Some of them are set in the distant future. But there's a bunch of different ideas that you see sort of recurring in different things. There's this one concept of it's introduced in the Christmas episode, the fourth episode of the second season. It's this concept of a cookie, when you basically take a copy of somebody's personality and put it into something electronic somewhere. And you see that idea of the cookie coming up a bunch of different times, not necessarily using the same language, but the same idea is there in a bunch of different episodes. And as a neat connection, this game company, Saitogemu, they also apparently make the game that is the focus of the first episode of the most recent season, Striking Vipers, which is like an immersive VR fighting game. But apparently it's made by the same company, which is an interesting thing. Are they piloting this immersive VR haptic feedback technology in playtest, and that's the same sort of technology that they use later on for Striking Vipers? So it's a neat little connection between the episodes there.
That's really neat that they've got these like standalone stories, but also like there is a little bit of lore there to connect threads between them. I like that. That's pretty.
It's neat little things. They got this the Black Mirror logo, I guess. It kind of looks like a little, like an upside down Y. It kind of looks like a little Space Invader or something like that. It's a pixelated little thing. It was a logo. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, there's a point, yeah, in Bandersnatch where it shows up in a very unexpected way.
Yeah, that little symbol is in a whole bunch of different episodes. And interestingly enough, in this episode, if you remember when Cooper does the first trial of the game, folks at home, we're skipping all over the place in terms of plot here, by the way. Just to fill you in, Cooper ends up going onto the app. He finds this place, Saitogemu, and he ends up going there, and he's going to test out some new game technology, right? And it's this immersive VR stuff. Is that good? Did I catch people up? I think I caught them up now.
Yeah, I think you did. And Sonia also mentions that, like, hey, if you can get a photo of something there, that could be worth a lot of money.
So he goes in and he's going to test out this game. And the first thing that they have him do is this game, they put these circular, they look like QR codes that are down on the table in front of him. And they install this little mushroom looking thing in the back of his neck. And I guess that's supposed to be the piece of hardware that's going to show him all of this VR stuff, right? I guess it's going to connect to his nervous system and show all this stuff that he's supposed to see. On those little QR codes, though, it's so much exposition for this little tiny thing I saw. On these QR codes, it's got that same symbol, that little upside down Y. It's on there, too. So he's playing this game. And it basically, it's like this whack-a-mole thing, and he can see it all because it's being projected inside of his head, but the woman running it for him, her name's Erica, she can't see any of it because she doesn't have the mushroom in the back of her head there, which is a weird sentence to say out of context. But anyway, so he's,
yeah.
he's playing this game, whack-a-mole sort of thing, and it's all good. He likes it, and she suggests that he tests out this like beta version that their thing, this more advanced version of the software that they're working on, which he adamantly says, yeah, absolutely, let's do it, right?
Yeah, he's gung-ho to keep going, and they bail out of that room. Mm-hmm. They go to a home, and he recognizes the house. It's from a game he's played as a kid.
Yeah, it's the game that the company is well known for. I think it's called Harlech Shadow or something like that. I'm also going to correct myself previously. The woman's name is not Erica, it's Katie, which I have written down in this Google document, and I ignored what I wrote.
She looks like an Erica.
Yeah.
I can see it.
It's got an E. It's got a K. We're halfway there. She takes him out to this Harlech Shadow thing and this Harlech Shadow mansion, and basically says that it's going to be this immersive horror game experience, which is going to respond to his fears and the stuff that he's experiencing, and it's going to create a horror game that's personalized immediately to him. So it's going to read his feelings and thoughts and create this game, this experience, which is entirely unique to him.
I think you see where, yeah, things start going bad. Although it's interesting that, like, you might be listening and wondering, so when do things start going bad? Because if you are watching this episode, we're at about the halfway point of the entire runtime of the episode, which you can see on Netflix. It's like, you know, a 43-minute total runtime. We're at like minute 20. And so far, Cooper has hooked up with a woman and gotten an odd job testing a video game.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Cooper's having a bad day particularly.
No, not yet. Not yet.
Not yet, nope.
You know, he starts out, he's got the mushroom in the back of his head, and he's got an earpiece.
She says, when she gives it to him initially, she shows it to him. She's like, we call this a mushroom. And he's like Mario Brothers. And I'm like, and when he said that, I'm like, we get it. He plays video games. Like, it's a mushroom like Mario Brothers, or like a regular mushroom.
And I don't know that even I would necessarily associate with Mario Brothers a mushroom that causes me to alter my perception of reality.
Right? Like, you could make any other more logical jumps. Like, Mario Brothers mushroom is probably going to be far down the list.
So he does have the mushroom in the back of his head, and he's got an earpiece, so Katie can continue to communicate with him while he's experiencing the game. And at first, he's chilling out, maxing and relaxing all cool. But then a couple of guys from his neighborhood show up and cause him trouble. And one of them is just like, you know, plain old spider.
It's just a spider. That's the first thing that he sees. There's a couple of moments earlier in the episode. I think when Cooper first gets into Saitogemu, there's like a guy who walks by with a big spider on his shirt. There's a couple. I think there's another instance when there's like a spider that's shown in some way or another. There's a couple of other like allusions to spiders before he actually encounters this first spider.
And he's not too bothered by that, although it does kind of get under his skin when it gets really close to him. But then we get, like, I think the first big jump scare where he runs into his former childhood bully, Josh Peters, who, was he a goth, or was that like a horror version of Josh Peters?
Yeah, I guess it's like a horror version. I feel like there was a maybe a poster on the wall, or somebody was working on something like a, like 3D modeling software or something like that. And they had a similar looking guy, like with the cloak and the dark black greasy hair and the hat and that sort of stuff. They, I feel like I remember it earlier in the episode. Now that he's in the game, he sees that guy and he's put his own fears into it as well. So he's got his fear of spiders, which is in there, and then he's got his fear of this childhood bully that he had in there, who's now sort of merged together with the software. And this is kind of where you start to see the rest of the software taking him. So the the whole point of it is that it's trying to create a horror experience that's unique to him. And so they're starting to blend their own things with his fears specifically. And you really start to see this in this creepy guy who looks like his bully.
Well, we can, yeah, I think we get it though. I think that's, it's starting to become more personal as it gets to, as time progresses. And like the the next step obviously is after a spider, and after Josh Peters is a Josh Peters spider.
Yeah, mashing them together, that is the next logical progressive step.
And like, even at this point you can see that like Cooper is still, he's unnerved, but it's still like within his expectations, I think, of what a, like a scary experience would be. So he's not completely, he's still like, okay, well, this is pretty weird, but
he's still curious. Like, he gets right up next to this giant spider that he sees, and he's kind of looking at it and checking it out. It's still kind of weird. He's initially put off by it, but then he's checking it out and he's not entirely put off by it.
I got a quote directly from the episode. It's a spider with a huge face and dicks coming out of its mouth.
Yeah, that's how I would describe it, I guess. Well, the next thing that happens, that spider, I guess, he leaves and there's a knock at the door suddenly. And who should show up in the mansion but Sonya, the woman that he had spent the night with and who suggested that he check out this gaming company for this work here. And she's super insistent that he get out of there. Like, it's bad. They're testing out all sorts of new dangerous technology and stuff, and he's in danger. And initially, Cooper's very skeptical of all of this. He thinks that it's something that the game is putting together, and she's not real, until Sonya actually ends up touching him or interacting with him, which I should mention, the developers of the game said wasn't possible. They said nothing's going to be able to harm you or come in contact with you, but Sonya does it at this point, and now he suddenly thinks, oh crap, she must be real, she must be here.
Because like, you as the viewer feel like you can see where this is going, where Cooper is in disbelief, but it's like, okay, we accept that Sonya is real because we've already, we know the rules. Sonya would be, if she wasn't real, he wouldn't be able to bump into her. And then Cooper starts poking holes in the explanation for why Sonya is even there. And he's like thinking that it's just like going to be another illusion. But then Sonya picks up a knife.
Yeah. So all of a sudden she goes from being concerned and caring, and her initial concept of I'm here to get you out, that doesn't seem to be working. And then it shifts and she picks up a knife, and now she's there to hurt him, and she starts swinging a knife at him.
And it's a really grisly fight too. Like,
yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. So, just as a, I suppose, a gore warning here, the knife ends up going through Cooper's shoulder. She stabs him in the back, and then he falls on the ground on his back, and she pushes him down, and the knife gets pushed further into his shoulder. And if, right? And if that wasn't bad enough, what happens then is Sonya's face, I guess, kind of glitches out or whatever, and just becomes sort of this, like, skull with like blood and viscera on it, and Cooper's screaming the entire time, and he's trying to grab
he's just,
it up.
Yes.
But yeah, right. I don't know if I needed to clarify that. It's not like Cooper's totally fine with all of this. No, he's quite concerned. He ends up pulling this person, whatever this is, the head down onto the knife and kills whatever it is, only to discover immediately afterwards that it was all a simulation.
He kind of like blinks and then like he looks back and his wound isn't there. His clothes aren't disturbed. Sonya is completely gone. And he gets back in touch with Katie, who had been out of communication for a little bit there. They lost contact, and then she comes back in, and it's starting to like unravel for Cooper at this point, where he's just like, he wants to get out and he needs the experiment to end now.
Yeah. They had previously established like a safe word, you know, you say a word and we'll stop the whole thing. And he appropriately suggests the word stop. So, Katie says, okay, yep, we'll end it. But all you got to do is you got to go up the stairs and you got to get to the door at the top. It's the only way to get out of there. And he starts losing his mind at this point.
Yeah. There's a pretty great moment where they have him walk up the stairs, and as a very overt reference, they say, would you kindly open the door? Yeah, which is, for people who aren't familiar, a reference to the BioShock game, the original BioShock, where your character is kind of led around by being told, would you kindly do this thing?
It's not too bad. Like, it makes sense in the context. It doesn't seem forced. But at the same time, since I know where it's coming from, I'm like, okay, I get it. But it does seem a little forced at the same time, especially because she's like, just open the door, open the door. Would you kindly open the door? And it's like, okay. So, he opens the door. There's a big, freak out. He gets into the room. He starts looking in this mirror, realizes he doesn't know who he is, where he is, what's going on. Katie and, Sho Saito, the lead developer behind the studio, they come out and they try and help him out, and they end up getting him out of there. But, it was a super, super intense experience for him. And they apologized profusely, saying that it was far more intense than they realized it would be, and they didn't mean for it to get that far. And they send him on his way. They put him in a car, and he leaves the mansion.
Yeah, and like it had ratcheted up, I think, to fears maybe he hadn't even realized himself, because the final torture for him is that he loses all of his memories. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that was an unresolved psychosis or stress that he had not himself put together. And maybe he had after the traumatic experience, because he basically gets out of the office and goes right home.
Yep.
And goes to talk to his mom.
Yeah. And then, as if we weren't revealing everything about the episode already. if you've been listening to all of this so far and you're like, okay, I'm cool with all of this, but as long as they don't spoil the last couple of minutes, I'll be fine. Then,
yeah.
So he gets home and he starts talking to his mom, and she doesn't realize that he's there, and she picks up the phone and she's like, I gotta call Cooper. And he says like, mom, and then it cuts back to the room where he was originally playing the whack-a-mole gopher game with the QR codes, and he had been there the whole time. They had just put the mushroom in the back of his neck, and then his phone went off. He was receiving a call from his mom, but I guess the interference from his phone, or rather the phone caused interference with the game, and it basically fried him, like just sent him haywire. And so he just starts saying, mom, 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 and has a seizure and basically dies as a result of that. So all this stuff that he experienced was just in a fraction of a second since he got that mushroom put into the back of his neck.
And the phone was dialing because Katie had tried to take the phone away from him, confiscate it, but Cooper kind of grabbed it back when there was a second where Katie was distracted so he could take a photo of the AR set to send to Sonya, because she had asked for a photo of it. And like in the hurry to like get back, and so Katie didn't realize what he'd done. He just kind of threw the phone back on the desk, didn't turn it back off.
The final, I guess the final shot of it, Sho Saito comes in and says, like, hey, what happened there? And she's, and Katie says, well, I don't know. The phone went off and must have caused some interference. And Saito says, okay, well, did he say anything? And Katie says, yeah, he kept saying mom. And then he was like, oh, that's weird. Make a note of that. And then the last thing that you see is Katie typing information into it and saying, like, the duration of the trial was a fraction of a second, and cause of death was phone interference. And then under special notes, she writes, called mom, in quotations, I think. And I just thought it was such a weird way to write that down. Like, you're not gonna write, like, said mom, or, you know, he said mom over and over. She wrote down called mom, but it's a weird way to write it, but it brings it all nice and together is what I'm trying to say.
It feels like the resolution to a Goosebumps book is what it makes me think of.
Yeah, sure. Just a real silly, over the top ending. Is that what you're saying?
The horror was so intense and so visceral, and then it's like da 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 da.
Yep, that's it.
I do need to call out one other thing too. That Cooper always says mom, mm-hmm. but in the subtitles, it always says mum.
It does say mum, doesn't it? All the British characters are saying mum. He's saying mom. The subtitles say mum. His phone says mom. I don't get it. It's horribly inconsistent. I don't know whether it's mom or mum. What are we as the viewers supposed to do here?
It is a United States citizen stereotype. That's what it is right there. They all say mom.
Absolutely unbelievable. I like this episode. I mean, I think you're going to be hard pressed to find an episode of that show that I don't like, because they're all so different. But I like that episode. It's just a nice, not a nice experience, I guess, but it's just a well told story. And the fact that video games and being a gamer is just so integral to the plot is pretty neat. It's not like a thrown off, like one off sort of thing. There's one shot where a couple of characters are playing video games. No, Cooper's in this situation because he is a gamer, and it was really only him that would be in this situation. It's neat that that's the crux. That's what makes the plot go forward, is that because he is a gamer, all this stuff happens to him.
So Cliff, with all of these different TV shows or movies that we review here on Screen Watching, we use three specific criteria to judge them.
Okay.
And, you know, it's a very rigorous process. And just like as though we were reviewing a video game, we always go off of the scale from 6 to 10, just as any video game would operate.
Yep, absolutely. 6 is the absolute lowest that game can score, right?
Right. So the first criteria is accuracy. So if you found the video games portrayed in Black Mirror's playtest completely inaccurate, give this a 6. If you found them lifelike accurate, give it a 10.
There's a couple of different situations where you see him playing games. And some of them are accurate, and some of them are not accurate. I'm going to say a 7. And the reason I'm saying a 7 is because you see Cooper playing a little, like, handheld game earlier, and that looks like it's a game. He plays that gopher thing, and you know what you're supposed to do there. But when he gets into the house, is it a game? Like, is he supposed to be trying to accomplish something? Is it just a, like, immersive VR situation? I don't know. So that's why I give it a 7 out of 10.
I think I'm going to have to go with a 7 as well. I think it was neat that they put in, like, actual video game titles into Sonya's apartment, and they had a couple video game references explicitly to existing titles. But I just, maybe AR technology has gone to an advanced level that I haven't seen yet, but I don't think it's possible to do anything, even with the gopher game. Like, that seems pretty amazing right there.
That does seem pretty amazing. I remember the first time I was using just the QR cards that come bundled with the Nintendo 3DS, and like putting that down on the table, and you show the camera on there, and oh my god, there's like a piranha plant or something. I'm like, that's amazing, but it wasn't implanted in my neck. So I think that's the important difference there.
All right, next up is condescension. So if you found this episode to be not condescending to gamers or gaming at all, give it a 6.
Hmm.
If you found it to be extremely condescending towards gamers or gaming, give it a 10.
I'm going to give it a 7 as well, because I don't think that it was particularly condescending. There were a couple of things, like the, it's a mushroom, like Mario Brothers. I thought that that was a little, that was a little weird. But there were a couple other, like the nods, like the would you kindly. We didn't mention as well that you can see on the screen that Cooper's last name is Redfield, which I think is apparently a reference to Resident Evil. And that's another thing that you may not have caught unless you're familiar with those games. So I don't think it's particularly condescending. They're not hitting you over the head with it. But I will subtract points or add points a little bit, I guess, in terms of condescension, just for that mushroom reference.
Yeah, I maybe should have thought out the condescension thing differently, because it's kind of opposite of what you would expect in terms of the scoring.
Yeah, as soon as you said it, I thought that, but I was like, nah, it's his scale. I'll go with it.
So I'm going to go with a 6, because I feel like they portray the studio, the game studio, mm-hmm. and like this woman who writes for the tech journal is just like, it's a normal thing that people do. Mm-hmm. It's never like Cooper never questions it. There's never like any real time spent to be like, I mean, they explain the AR video game, but it's never like, people make money selling video games or anything like that.
Yeah, that's true. It's all, no one is ever like that. This is a well-respected studio. They want to get in there and see what they're working on. Everybody understands what they're doing and who they are. Yeah, not once are people saying anything condescending about it or dismissive either.
And then lastly, we have entertainment. So just, if you found this Black Mirror episode to be completely unentertaining, give it a 6. If you found it to be extremely entertaining, give it a 10.
I'm gonna give it a 10. I think it's super entertaining. That's part of the pull of all these Black Mirror episodes, is that they do such a good job of setting up the world and explaining things to you without being really overt. They do a real good job about telling you the story just by showing it to you instead of just explicitly saying it. All the Black Mirror episodes are just really super, super well done. I'm sure I might get a little bit of hate from people saying, well, some episodes are better than others, and I agree on that, but I think overall they're fantastic. So I'm definitely going to give it a 10 for entertaining.
I'm going to give it a 9. I found it very well made, and as far as horror goes, very effective, all up to the very, very last second. I did think that was a little cheesy. Just as a personal bias, that's maybe, it's hard for me to watch. Like, it's just not something I'm really planning to sit down and watch normally is a horror film or a long horror TV episode. So
sure.
I can admire the how good it is at what it does, but it's for me, I'm not objective about it. I got to be subjective.
Sure. Fair enough. I do not disagree with your assessment.
Well, and then in that case, I think that brings our screen watching segment to a close. Cliff, we're going to go on a quick break here. And when we come back, I'll be talking with Harris Foster over at Finji. And we're back from break. Joining me on this palatial VoIP line for the second time now is Harris Foster. Harris is the community manager over at Finji. Finji is currently in progress on Overland, Tunic, and Wilmot's Warehouse. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
So, the last time you were on, it was you, Adam, and I talking. We talked a bit about like the studio's history and Overland and its development. This time I was hoping to talk about like the past year, because it's been about a year since you were last on, and just like I think a lot has changed in the gaming industry for independent games, and just get to know you a little bit better as well.
Sweet. Yeah, that sounds like a great plan to me for sure.
We did cover it a bit in our previous episode, so by all means, listeners, go and check that out. But if you could give like a quick like elevator pitch about Overland, what it's about, I think that would help people.
Yeah, for sure. Overland is a turn-based survival strategy game that takes place at the end of the world in America. You play as these randomly generated survivors who are tasked with starting on the east coast of the country and journeying to the west coast via these like beat-up jalopy cars that they come across. And every level is this like procedurally generated little diorama where your goal is you come in via your car, you explore outwards from your car, you gather resources such as, you know, weapons and med kits, but most importantly, gasoline. And then you get back to your car, fill it up with gasoline, and you're off to the next place. And really, like, the biggest staple of Overland is the choices that you have to make. So a lot of the encounters will involve perhaps sacrificing one of your player characters so that the others may live, or in between levels, you're tasked with choosing your next stop. So it could be, there's a survivor that we can hear crying for help in this direction, whereas we also need medical supplies for the people we already have. So do we head down to another location to get those supplies? It's a huge game about choice and survival, and we're actually coming real close to launch, which will be in the fall.
That's super exciting. And I know at the time, I think some of where it was going to end up in terms of platforms was TBD. But since that time, we've found out that it will be out on the Nintendo Switch, out on PC, and also out on Apple Arcade.
It's going to be on everything. It's going to be on, Switch, PC, Mac. It's going to be on PS4. It's going to be on Xbox One. Apple Arcade, too. We're super stoked to be part of, like, the pioneering class of Apple Arcade, one of the first games to be available on that platform. We are super, super pumped to have it on there.
You know, between Apple Arcade and like Stadia, and then other like streaming services like Game Pass, and then even alongside conventional digital and physical retail, it feels like for independent games, there's more opportunities now than ever before to get your game out into the world.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, it's so cool to, you know, go to conventions where you see your friends who are indie game developers, and every one of them is talking about how excited they are to be working with X partner. You know, like every single person, every time I see somebody who I'm, you know, great friends with, they're excited that they're working with this like new company who just joined in, or this company who's, you know, been ambivalent on indie games and now is like super into indie games. It's such a terrific time to be making these games because there's so much new competition that I think it's, you know, not only great for the creators that, you know, we get attention from these platforms, but it's great for the consumer because you've got so many new opportunities to play these games. I'm super stoked for Overland on Apple Arcade because of, I think about like whenever I travel personally, like, you know, normally I have my Switch with me, which is great for like traditional Switch games, but I don't have too many like super deep games on my iPad. And like, I'm like really pumped to play Overland on my iPad, like on a flight or something, because it like looks great on iPad. It runs great on iPad. And like, that's just like one of many ways people can just play so many cool indie games nowadays. It's so awesome.
I agree completely. Yeah. And like, there's ways that these different platforms offer new audiences to creators as well, where people who might never pick up a keyboard or mouse might pick up a Switch, or they might pick up their iPad, or they might pick up a DualShock, stuff like that.
Every single platform has their like special thing, which is really cool. Like, you know, on one hand, this is like the closest gaming has ever been to like parody. Like, this is not like, you know, the Super Nintendo version looks worse than the Genesis version. Like, we're beyond that, but we're actually like, this is the most varied as well, because like, you've got things like Stadia, where you don't need a console, you don't, you know, all you need is your internet connection and a controller, and you're good to go. And like, the entry point, like the cost of entry to that, as long as you've got a decent internet connection, can bring in so many new people who previously, you know, couldn't afford a home gaming console. And then you've got, you know, the thing, you think about the Switch, which, like, you think about the portability of it, which is obviously great. And this is kind of changing a little bit with the Switch Lite, but, like, with the regular Switch, you're getting a console that ships with two controllers automatically, technically. Like, you know, we have it in handheld one, that's one handheld mode, that's one controller, but then, you know, take the two Joy-Cons off, separate them, you've got two controllers. Every single console has their neat little factor, and it's so cool to see them not being so samey anymore. I really like that. Yeah.
There was a little bit of backlash recently against the Switch Lite, I believe, because people, I think Switch owners were hoping to see something that they could also buy, when maybe they were missing the point where now probably a whole new generation of young people can enjoy a Switch Lite instead.
Yeah, and you know, the Switch Lite is not for someone who already owns a Switch. You're exactly right. Like, it is $100 cheaper, and with that you get sacrifices. And I think, you know, the only real thing that I think is surprising is the fact that it doesn't have TV out. But other than that, the Switch Lite makes total sense to me, and it's a great, like, second Switch for your family. You know, if you've got, you know, dad who likes to play video games, but, you know, his son or daughter always wants to, you know, all have a turn at the Switch, this is that product. And I think that I think the Switch Lite is genius, frankly. If it wasn't for the fact that I already own a Switch, I would probably choose the Switch Lite over the regular Switch, because I like the size of it, I like the colors of it, I like the real D-pad of it. Yeah. If, you know, maybe I'll change my tune if they release some real D-pad Joy-Cons, but yeah, the Switch Lite is awesome. I, you know, controversial statement, but I think the Switch Lite is going to be the best PlayStation Vita ever released.
The Vita means life, even if it's no longer with
Vita
Sony.
Does mean life.
Well, Harris, if we can circle back around on one thing you mentioned, it sounded like there is more enthusiasm now from partners trying to find independent creators and for creators trying to find partners. And Finji kind of straddles that line themselves, in that you make your own games. You have your project Overland. And you also work with other developers in bringing their games to completion. And one of them is Wilmot's Warehouse.
Yeah, that's right. Wilmot's Warehouse is a super, super awesome game. I say it's secretly, but not so secretly, Finji's best game. Like, Wilmot's Warehouse is so, so good. And that's by Ricky Haggett and Richard Hogg, two of the minds who made a little game called Hohokam. Near the PS4 launch, are now working with us to make Wilmot's Warehouse. And the game started off as a, you know, proof of concept, kind of this idea that one of the Richards had, that was essentially, you know, they worked in a warehouse and they wanted to turn that into a game. So they built this little project, you know, on a very short time span, and they released it as a Humble Bundle original. So that came to Humble Bundle's Trove category, which is, if you subscribe to Humble Monthly, you get access to the Trove, which is this catalog of, like, cool little games as well as some, like, big ones that you can access all the time for free with your subscription. And that was one of the bonus original games that came with that. And in part of the development process, you know, Adam and Becca got a hold of it, and they saw potential in Wilmot's Warehouse to be this game that they really wanted the world to experience. And so that's really part of Finji's mission, is that, you know, Finji isn't the game studio publisher that is looking to maximize revenue on a game, or, you know, use search engine optimization terms to figure out what it is players like. Finji really just wants to get weird projects out into the world that otherwise wouldn't be experienced, and that would be like a shame to go unnoticed. And that is exactly what Wilmot's Warehouse is. Like, Wilmot's Warehouse, I call it Finji's best game because, like, it's this weird thing that you don't see. Like, Wilmot's Warehouse, there's this concept I, like, talk about a lot on Twitter that Wilmot's Warehouse really reminds me of, and that's something called Weird Nintendo. And Wilmot's Warehouse feels like, you know, like WarioWare, Rhythm Heaven,
Rusty's like Real Deal Baseball.
Yeah, exactly. It's games that, you know, come from this big, big studio that feel really small and weird, and that's what Wilmot's Warehouse is. And on the surface, Wilmot's Warehouse, like, doesn't look weird at all. Like, it's this, you know, really simple puzzle game about a square little dude with a face who goes around a warehouse and pushes blocks around and sorts inventory. But then, like, you get into the story, and, like, the game takes place in, like, 1984 Britain, and Wilmot has a boss who's a jerk, and, like, there's, like, this, like, whole narrative in the game that we don't really acknowledge because it's not super part of the, you know, face value marketing, but it's fascinating. And, yeah, I am, you know, we've got the two launches this year, Overland in the fall, Wilmot's will be before that, and I am, like, so pumped to see how people respond to Wilmot's. It's like, we show it at PAX, and people just, like, get locked into it. Like, we only ever have one demo station for it, and it'll take a bit for someone to warm up to it and, like, sit down and play, because it looks like a very intimidating game from the sidelines, but then they sit down and play it, and we've had people, like, look up after playing and realize their family's gone, and they have to, like, scour the PAX show floor to find them again, because the game just, like, locks you in. Yeah, I'm so stoked for Wilmot's. It is going to be really, really good.
What you've described up until now with regards to Finji's mission statement, that kind of feels like the what and the why. Is there, like, a how to it? Like, the Wilmot's Warehouse story sounds very personal. Like, the heads of the company took an interest in this game.
Yeah, that's really how a lot of Finji game projects get going, is that... It's a game, yeah. It's Adam, you know, is big in the indie game industry. He made Cannibalt, the first ever. He doesn't like to say first ever, but the original, we'll say, Endless Runner. And then also he did work on Cave Story and Fez and this and that. So he's built up his reputation as a collaborator in the indie space, and oftentimes, you know, people will come to the Saltzmans and say, hey, here's a little project I'm working on. I just want to get your feedback, this and that. And so many times the Saltzmans will get so invested in providing feedback that it just gets to the point where they say, we want to help you with this game to the fullest extent. Let's get it out there together. That's similar things happen with Night in the Woods. Similar things happen with Tunic. It's really, you know, there's a lot of different criteria that Finji has whenever it comes to choosing a game they will publish. There's, like, rules that we have to go through. For instance, one of them is the game has to be described using the word cozy. The game has to be able to, you have to be able to easily assume what the gameplay is from any given screenshot at any given moment. Another one is, like, Adam's mom has to be able to enjoy playing the game. No violence. Becca has to be able to play the game in front of her children. A lot of different, you know, aspects like that form a Finji game. And, yeah, Wilmot's is just that to a T. You know, all those different things clicked into place, and we latched onto Wilmot's.
That's awesome. Those rules, I had no idea there was, like, the kind of that, those guidelines or that credo to the curation process.
Yeah, we keep them secret because they're not, you know, they're not
hard rules. So we don't have to cut them here, though, right?
Yeah, no, you can keep them here. You can keep them in the podcast. But it's more that, like, we're not going to, like, put up a FAQ page on a website that says, don't bother us if you don't fit these criteria. But it's more that, like, that's how it always happens to be. For instance, like, you know, Adam developed and Finji published a game called Capsule, which takes place inside of a fictional submarine type vessel where you the only interface of the game is via a radar. And that game is incredibly scary from the sound design. It's, you know, the game centers around, like, maintaining oxygen levels and, you know, dangerous creatures that you can't see but you can hear, and your only indication of them is through this radar. And, like, you know, that game I would call something that's not a typically Finji game, but it ticks enough boxes that it's something that they felt good about making and putting out there. It's not like every one of those criteria ensures that, you know, we're going to publish your game, but it's more that, like, if you have these things, we can see that we would get along. You know what I mean?
If we can shift gears again a little bit here, I wanted to ask some questions about you and how you kind of navigate through the gaming culture, because at the most recent PAX, there was an event that you were very involved with called the Great PAX Bake Off. And I was just wondering if you could take me behind the scenes of that a little bit, like what inspired it and how did you get involved?
The Great PAX Bake Off, it sort of fell into my lap, but it also, like, it was a good lap to fall into because, like, I love cooking shows. Like, me and my girlfriend will spend hours just, like, watching, like, Chopped Junior and, like, MasterChef and, like, all these different cooking shows because, like, we can't cook, but whenever we watch these shows, all of a sudden we're, like, experts and we're yelling at the TV, like, oh, why are you using the heavy cream on this? You should be using half and half, and, like, just, like, screaming at our TV, even though we don't know any of this stuff, but, like, all of a sudden it feels like we're experts. And so I wanted to turn that feeling into a PAX panel, and I got the opportunity to whenever Becca, she had this idea for something called Overcooked Live, and she wanted to work with that's the name of the game, right? Overcooked, the co-op?
Yeah, that's right.
So she wanted to work with the devs of Overcooked to basically make this Overcooked sanctioned event that was a cooking competition that involved, like, switching, and, like, one person would be cooking and one person would be gaming. And then we would, like, you know, like, throw obstacles at him and things like that. But, you know, naturally with Becca being a CEO of a major media company, she didn't have time to organize such a thing. So one day she comes to me and she says, "Hey, I have this idea. It's called Overcooked Live. Let's turn it into a panel." I was like, okay, you know, I'll work on it, this and that. But we decided to do this so close to PAX that we couldn't, you know, get the Overcooked thing going. So I said, okay, well, what if we made it a parody of the Great British Bake Off? And I think it was actually her idea first to make it Easy Bake Ovens. She was like, I want to do something that's, you know, it's also like, you know, cooking as fast as you can and as safe as you can in front of a live audience. Easy Bake Ovens, that's your answer. And she came up with this Easy Bake Oven idea working with musical artist Dose One, who does music for games like Gang Beasts and Samurai Gun. He does a lot of really great music for games. And so they kind of put their brains together and said, okay, Easy Bake Ovens. I said, let's make it like the British Bake Off. And then so we simply just submitted a panel called the Great PAX Bake Off. And then we forgot about it. And then like 6 weeks later, there's an email in my inbox that says, "Hey, we selected your panel. It's time for the Great PAX Bake Off." And I was like, crap, we have nothing. Like this, oh, I forgot we did this. Oh, no. And so we just started scrambling to get guests. We ended up with a great crew. We had Felix Kramer, who's our producer on Tunic and who produces like every indie game you've ever played. We had Gabe McGill, who worked on Firewatch. Then we had Casey Malone, who, you know, does, I believe works on a Marvel game out in LA. And then of course, Abby Russell from Giant Bomb, came by, who is friends with us. Abby loves Finji games. And yeah, essentially we had this like whole complex television show like setup that we like I came up with the weeks leading up to PAX, and then so we're in Boston. The show is literally the next day, and I come to and Becca was like, okay, I handed the show off to you. What do you have for me? And I basically broke down how I wanted the show to go. And Becca explained to me that there was no way we could fit all these crazy ideas I had in 1 hour. Like there was like sabotages and like some kind of like what at one point you had to like there was, I had the idea of you had to do 3 different pastries in 1 hour, which impossible. But I did the math and I was like, if we don't miss a single beat, we could do 3 cupcakes in 1 hour, which I was crazy for that. But like one of them was that you had to do a Sonic the Hedgehog cupcake, but one of the contestants couldn't use blue icing. And then there was another point where like one of the contestants had to crush up goldfish crackers and sprinkle it on a cupcake. And we just tossed all of that out the window. We said, let's simplify it. Let's do different prompts for every person, but it's just one baked good at the end. And that was like the Great PAX Bake Off that you see on that stream looks like it went really well, but it came together like literally 25 minutes before the actual show. Yeah, we went to Target and we completely bought out their entire like pastry area. The mixture that they use during the Bake Off is not actually Easy Bake Mix, but it's like this like gross it's like this gross oven, or I'm sorry, microwave mug mix. So it's like cake mix that you're supposed to pour in a coffee mug with water and then just like rises in the microwave, and it tastes terrible in the microwave, so it's going to taste even more terrible when it's like being cooked by a light bulb. But yeah, it ended up being this like hilarious, amazing, like simulated trash fire. And like I really have to thank, like, you know, all the contestants were hilarious. Like Gabe was like drinking Mountain Dew Code Red and taking shots of it, and like you know, Abby was doing really good improv, and like all of our judges who we got back, we're promo time, we're doing this again at PAX West, and we got the same judges, which I'm so thankful for. I'm just rambling here at this point. But like,
I think we got the contestants, but who are the judges for the show?
So the judges are Becca Saltzman, my boss. Then we have Gwen Frey, who's an artist. I'll need to look up the name of Gwen's game real quick. It's a lovely looking puzzle platformer. And then we also have Chris Slight, who works at XSplit, and as well as Meow Wolf, which is a cool art installation in New Mexico.
Meow Wolf was great.
Yeah. So Chris does a lot of organizational stuff at Meow Wolf. He's a hilarious British man. And so that's like one of the rules I want to set up for the Bake Off going forward, is that if we can't ever get Chris to be a judge, we have to get some British man, because that is like pure British Bake Off like requirement. Okay, and Gwen's game is called Kine, K-I-N-E. It is a really, really cool puzzle platformer. So doing that again at West. Our contestant lineup is in the process of being built right now. But so far we have Victoria Tran from Kit Fox, community manager at Kit Fox. And then we also have Marlo Dobb, who is an artist working on Dicey Dungeon, and also famous for making like the viral Wah Luigi board that you might have seen on Twitter. And we have 2 unannounced guests that we're like locking in for sure. But if we get them, it's going to be a real good time. Yeah, Bake Off is so good. I'm hoping to get a prize of some kind this year, and also make some even more fun multiplayer game challenges that the contestants love to compete in. So I'm really looking forward to it. It is such a good time.
Now, what do you think drives this, I guess, performing spirit? I mean, between it really it seems to fall with the game makers and the influencers and the press. Like, everyone comes together for this from, like, all sides of the equation. I mean, you see it in the Bake Off and then in the PAX Rumble as well.
It was shocking to me that the Bake Off, it was a sold out crowd at the Bake Off. Like, they were turning people away at the PAX doors because we filled up the entire theater, and that blew my mind. And I think what it is like, you know, game creators and people who work in games, like, in the end, I don't consider myself an artist by any means. Like, I can't draw, I can't do this and that, but we all want to, like, express ourselves in a way that other people really enjoy. And I think, like, this is just, like, another form of that. You see a lot of game developers, like, as you said, like, really interested in professional wrestling. And I think it's because, like, you know, just like we appreciate how, like, a game is made, we can also appreciate how wrestling is, like, orchestrated. And, like, you see, like, a lot of, like, game developers or, like, games critics, like, you know, like, the McElroy brothers, they love podcasting, but they also love The Bachelor. And it's like that. I don't think they watch it because they genuinely care about these people's, like, experiences, but more because they are able to, like, turn their brain off and, like, realize what went into making such a production. And then, you know, they enjoy just, like, you know, digesting that and things like that. And so I think, like, when given the stage and when given the opportunity to, like, do these fantastic things, these game creators will, like, take what they know about making one type of entertainment and try to turn it into another. And yeah, that's a great question. Like, I have a super great time, you know, constructing that Bake Off and, you know, making trailers for it and getting people hyped for it. And also at the same time, like, yeah, being in the League of Heels, I was on stage for, I think, less than 20 seconds because I got knocked out immediately. But just, like, seeing everyone backstage and they're all happy to, like, be part of this weird theater performance, really just goes to show that, like, they just, like, love expressing themselves in a way that's different from their 9-to-5.
It's really funny to me that, like, the game is so extraneous to the whole experience of the PAX Rumble, but, like, there also are a handful of people who really know how WrestleMania 2000 works and yes. can, like, do all the counters and know the perfect way to knock someone out of the ring.
No, you're exactly right. That was my major downfall, is that all the people who didn't know how to play were already knocked out by the time I got a chair. So the second I get in the ring, I think it was Aaron Trites immediately just punches my wrestler in the face and I'm on the ground, like, knocked out immediately. yeah, it's... but yeah, no, definitely, like, professional wrestling, the real thing, quote-unquote real, is not about the actual wrestling. Like, that is very important, but the main reason why, at least, you know, our segment of the universe watches wrestling is for these dumb storylines and these dumb fake realities they're making. That's why I went to the Rumble for years and years before I was a part of it, not because I care about WrestleMania 2000. Like, if they wanted, if the show was about the game, they would have picked a better game. Like, we played Gang Beasts during the Bake Off, and that elicited way more of a crowd reaction than I've ever heard WrestleMania 2000 elicit. So yeah, it's way more about these dumb theatrics and things of that nature.
There is, you, of course, you are the host and you're organizing the Great PAX Bake Off, but there was a more recent event where you were a guest. You were a guest. I'm a big fan of Giant Bomb. I assume you are a big fan as well. And you were on the couch for the E3 shows this year at Giant Bomb. And I'm really, really dying to know what that was like.
Yeah. So that was my second appearance on the Giant Bomb couch. First one being last year, where we get in. So first I'll preface this by talking about last year's experience. We get into the hotel where they shoot this, and it's basically two hotel, I wouldn't even call them ballrooms. It was just like these, like, side auxiliary rooms, the kind you would get, like, a, you know, timeshare presentation in. And half of it is dedicated to this green room that you see in between all the segments, where they have like free beer and like Rory's coming in and out the whole time dropping off free booze, and they have like these like shitty little snacks that no one likes, and they know no one likes them, but they have to buy it because of the hotel. So we're hanging out in there, it's a good time. They have that live camera set up, and I'm like going up and like pretending to like pick my teeth in it or whatever. And then we get pulled in for our interview segment. Jan Ochoa goes around everyone with a clipboard. He says, "Hey, what's your name and how do you spell it?" And I told him, "My name is Harris Foster, HARRISFOSTER. He's like, "Cool, great, awesome." So we get all situated in our chairs for the first interview, and I spend an hour in that seat talking to Jeff. And then I come out of the interview and I look at my phone, and I just get screenshot after screenshot of my friends who are watching, who show me that they spelled my name wrong on the lower third of the screen, despite the fact that I told Jan my name. And and rather than being mad at him, I think this is the funniest thing in the world, because I get a bunch of people following me who are like, "Hey, I came here from Giant Bomb, but I think this is the right guy. I don't know. I'm looking for Harris Forrest. I don't know who this is, blah, blah, blah." And so from then on, like for weeks, people start calling me Harris Forrest. There was one guy, like while I was at E3, I was like walking to an appointment, and this guy stops me and goes, "Hey, you were on TV last night. You're Forrest, right?" And I was like, no. I mean, yes, I guess. So I get on. So fast forward a year later to this year, and we get asked to be on the show again. Apparently people loved us last year because we didn't talk about video games at all, and we just goofed off for an hour. And knowing Giant Bomb,
pretty well.
Yeah, that's what Giant Bomb's all about. So yeah, so we get asked to be on again, and I walk in to into the green room, and Jan looks at me. He's like, "Hey, I'm so sorry for spelling your name wrong last year. Like, that was my bad. Like, I am blah, blah, blah. I'm so, so sorry." I was like, "Jan, it's okay. I want you to do it again." and he says, what? I was like, yeah. It's become such an inside joke. It's such a good goof that I need you to, you know, just get creative with it. Do whatever you want." It's like, "Oh, you're saddling me with a lot. Like, this could go bad." I was like, "I trust you. I'm a premium member for years. Do it." He's like, "Okay, I'll see what I can do." And he proceeded to just do the best jokes of the entire week on my name. He, you know, he called me Harris Forrest flip-flop enthusiast at one point. I think he said, or it started off with my name, like everyone's name coming up, and then mine just being insert name here, insert job here as my like title under my name or under my person. And yeah, it ended up being just a wonderful, wonderful inside joke that continued through this year. It even so much as I don't think Jeff Gerstmann knows my actual name. On this year's Giant Bomb E3 couch, I told a story about how I was threatened by an energy drink influencer, and literally on day before yesterday's Bombcast, Jeff was talking about energy drinks, and he says over the mic, "I should ask Harris Forrest about this." And I don't know if he was joking or not. Being on that couch was surreal, man. Like, I watched E3 at night all throughout college, and loved every minute of it. And yeah, to be a part of that was so, so cool. And No hyperbole. I think it's my favorite thing that I do every year, period. Just like, it's just my favorite thing that I do. It is so much fun.
I'm really glad. And just so you know, before I didn't realize, to be honest, you had been on last year. So like, I watched your interview this year, and I was like, "Oh no, they got his name wrong." And they got it wrong again. And like, when I was talking with you to set up the interview, I was like, "Should I even ask about the Giant Bomb thing? Maybe he's mad about it."
No, it is. It's a great, great goof. Because it's not only limited to Giant Bomb. It's like, you know, I have a pretty, in my opinion, I have a pretty easy name, right? Harris Foster. sure, they're both last names, but that's my name, right? Pretty common names. But, like, so many times in my life, people spell my name wrong. And so to have it happen on, you know, the thing I was most excited about on the grandest scale of audience I've ever had is really just the most classic thing to happen to me. So, like, I'm so over it at this point that, like, for that to happen, it was pure comedy. It was hilarious. So, yeah, like, I, you know, if you go on my Twitter right now, which is Harris Foster, my pinned tweet is, like, a thread of all the times my name has weirdly been spelled wrong.
Well, that's incredible. I'm glad that there was, I think by leaning into it so much, you've really, you've made it your own thing now. So congrats on that.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's my usernames on all the game systems are just Harris Foster. I've never been good at writing custom usernames. I don't really have an online handle. So recently, whenever the PSN name change was introduced, I asked people online, I was like, hey, what should I change my PSN name to? And every single suggestion was some different misspelling of my own name. like, you know, Rami Ismail, who Vlambeer made, you know, like all those great indie games, wind up Super Crate Box, Ridiculous Fishing, all these things. He made a website that just randomly generates Harris Foster names by like some algorithm that like looks like a misspelling of my name. I think that, let me see if I know the URL for that.
I'm just Googling Harris Foster name generator. I'm seeing what I get.
So yeah, it is myownharrisfoster.com. And yeah, if you just hit that, you will get a randomly generated Harris Foster name.
Okay, so we will have an official Harris Foster name for this interview. It is, oh wow, Hokog Phone Circle.
Okay, all right, I like that.
It's Hokqog.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, Hokog, there is one final question I was hoping to ask you before we ended the call.
Yeah.
The last time you were on, we did a Pokemon themed question to wrap things up, and that's something I normally do with all my guests. But because you have answered the questions we had at that time, you know, I needed to come up with something new. So, in the spirit of Overland, I was thinking, if you could select one Pokemon of all the Pokemon that are out there to best survive the apocalypse, which one would it be?
So, like, I feel like there's a lot of Pokemon that you can have here that's, like, totally cheating, right? Like, take, for instance, like, Jirachi, right? Like, Jirachi's whole thing is that he grants wishes, right? So, like, if I could just, like, have a Jirachi and wish the world never ended, bada bing, bada boom, right? So if I'm, like, limiting myself in a way that makes things interesting and, like, keeping a survival element going, let's think. Let me get some inspiration for you. What would you pick for this?
Well, a Pokemon that is a renewable food source would be pretty handy. So one of the, like, a grass type, which maybe, like, could have its own, like, vegetables or even just, like, leaves, something like that is edible that I could use to nourish myself without harming the Pokemon. It would just be like, you know, snip off some hairs or whatever. That's where I'd be going. Or I guess this is a question I would have for you. Do water Pokemon make their own water? I assume they have to like be hydrated and they like have like a reserve that they're drawing from. They can't just like generate fresh water.
I think if Charmander's tail is always on fire, I think water Pokemon can make their own water.
In that case, you really gotta look to a water type then, I think, because like water has to be incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
In this doomsday future.
That's a good point. Part of me thinks of getting an electric type Pokemon simply so they can like charge any like safety devices I have, like a radio or like a phone, if I wanted to like, you know, do some entertainment in the time. I'm just like scrolling through a list of Pokemon right now.
That could be good though, because like water maybe makes you too much of a target, where electricity, you can just like hunker down in some apartment building somewhere and use your Pokemon to power all the appliances and stuff and just stay safe.
Get myself by like a riverbed and just like build a little cabin with that Pokemon. I'm scrolling through here. Nothing's really sticking out to me very much. I would probably just go with like an electric type, probably like a Pikachu, or if I'm like, you know, looking to actually like power something, Elekid or Electabuzz would probably be up there because they seem more like utilitarian. Those guys like have jobs as far as I'm concerned. I've played Pokemon Snap. I would something electric because, like, you know, playing Overland, electric generators are a big part of the game, and when a night level comes around, it's much harder to get around without visible light. Definitely electricity type.
Alrighty, awesome. That's perfect then. I'm gonna think about that some more because there is definitely some considerations there. Like you probably don't want to get like the evolved Pokemon. They eat a lot more food and stuff, so they'd be harder to take care of.
Yeah. Oh, I'm telling you. Yeah, maybe like a Pulsil or Minun. Although, are those? I mean, do they have to work together to be electric? I don't even know. Just give me the tiniest electric Pokemon. But see, if it's a tiny electric Pokemon, am I going to be, like, wearing them out by asking them to do electric things? Like, does that tire them out? Am I a jerk for asking them to, like, you know, run my iPhone for an hour? I don't know. There's a lot of ethical things that go into this. Like, you know, in the world of Pokemon, everyone's pretty well off, and the Pokemon, you know, subsist with the humans in a way that's like mutually beneficial. But if I'm like, what do I provide for that Pokemon? Why are they helping me? You know what I mean?
These are questions we tiptoe around every day when we allow Pokemon to exist as a media, as a fandom.
I think here's our homework. All right. We need to play Pokemon XD Gale of Darkness. Cause that's like apocalyptic, right? Am I misremembering that?
They're like corrupted Pokemon or something like
that. Yeah, because like if I need to see someone write Book of Eli but also with Pokemon, and then we'll have an answer to this.
I have my Wii right over there. I can try and track down a copy of Gale of Darkness. We'll regroup in like a month and talk about our book reports ready. In the meantime though, thank you so much, Harris, for your time. This has been fantastic. If you want people to find Finji, information about either, where can they find that info?
For sure. Yeah. I'm on Twitter at Harris Foster. Finji Twitter account is run by me as well. And that's Finji Co, FINJICO. We have a few games coming up this year. We have Wilmot's Warehouse, unannounced date, but, it will be soon. And then we have Overland coming to all major platforms in the fall. That's about it. We also have a Finji Discord that's really cool. Discord.gg/Finji. If you want to come hang out, I'm always in there. If you want to chat, say hello, that's a good place to find me.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
And we are back from break. One more time, big thanks to Harris over at Finji. I'm really looking forward to the games they've got coming out soon. They got Tunic coming out for Microsoft platforms and Wilmot's Warehouse.
Oh man, that's the company that makes Wilmot's Warehouse? I'm so stoked for that game. That looks awesome. There was Cool Ghosts, the guys from Shut Up and Sit Down, who did an episode that had Wilmot's Warehouse in it, and I saw it, and I've been trying to find it. I know it was a Humble thing, and I know it's not out yet, but it looks like it's going to be just fantastic, and I'm sure that tells you exactly what sort of person I am, that a game about organizing a warehouse looks thrilling to me.
Hey, it looks pretty good to me, too. I am looking forward to when that comes out as well, so you're in good company. Well, then, in that case, before we sign off for this episode, there is one thing I have to take care of, and this might be unfamiliar for you, but I am a big fan of Magic the Gathering.
Ah, I did know this about you.
Oh. Oh, well then I should skip that part and just explain that what I normally do is, so it doesn't leak out into the rest of the podcast, I devote about a random amount of time, up to a minute, to talking about magic so as I can just get it all out of my system. And it's called Bill's Magic Minute.
Okay. Well, I will try not to get you further down this inevitable spiral of magic.
So all I need is I'm going to roll a d20 on my end of the line here right now.
Okay.
I have 33 seconds to talk about this week's topic. The topic this week is going to be about the mechanic protection. And I just need you to keep time for me and to tell me to stop when it's time to stop.
Okay. I will start my timer. And 3, 2, 1, go.
I'm absolutely shocked that they reintroduced the mechanic protection from a color into the game of Magic, because it felt like it was incredibly complicated and not very rewarding for play. Even at the M20 pre-release, which I just recently attended, a lot of players were very confused about what could and could not be covered by protection, and me explaining it did not seem to really help. I had to fall back on the classic DET acronym, damage, enchantments, blocking, and targeting, but even that doesn't really fully encapsulate all the different corner cases that can come up, and I worry that there was no real reason to get into that rabbit hole without
Okay, that's definitely more than 33 seconds. I let that go for about 10 seconds longer because I started thinking, you're talking like circles of protection?
So I'm talking about how the creatures can have an ability like protection from red, and what does that mean?
Yeah, the only thing that I think of, like I mentioned, circles of protection. But yeah, if you're saying protection from red, that's a huge umbrella. How are you supposed to, is it damage from monsters? Is it from instants? Is it, I guess what you said, DET, but that's huge. That seems like that would be really unbalanced.
I'd really like to talk about it more, but I mean, the time is done.
Okay, so now we're getting into Cliff's Magic Minute, when he carefully considers what Bill was talking about with magic and tries to make sense of it. Okay, well, that's it. So we'd better not do that, because you could save that for your for all your other magic-related podcasts.
Sometime, some other time, we'll have a full magic podcast. Until then, though, I think that brings this episode of So Many Bits to a close. Cliff, thank you for coming back on. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your vacation here to join me.
It's my pleasure, Bill, and congratulations again on 200 episodes.
If you want people to find you anywhere, either like electronically or in person, where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter, at Mr. Cliffo, and I sometimes post there, and I more often than not do not post there. I'm also a part of a group called Moist Theater, and we perform improv in Toronto on a monthly basis at the Comedy Bar, so you can check us out on the Comedy Bar's website.
Awesome. And as for us, we can be reached by email at somanybitspodcast@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, we're So Many Bits on there. Follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at So Many Bits. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Please rate and review or download from Simplecast, from SoundCloud, or for a stream on Spotify. We play games, twitch.tv/SoManyBits, Wednesday and Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Central Time. Wednesdays, usually for Magic the Gathering Online or MTG Arena. Thursdays for a variety of different games. Recently I've played, Spider-Man, Transistor, Trauma Team, Griftlands, you know, a ton of different titles across a lot of different genres. If you want to find out more podcasts that are fun like mine, you can go to nerdlogs.com. So Many Bits is there, plus a bunch of other great ones. And last but not least, thank you very much for listening. Have a great summer. See, okay. The bit here also is I say have a great summer regardless of what time of year it is.
Okay, that's hilarious. Cool.